if I told you that today you'll leave here different?
Right here.
You are going to witness an absolute spectacle.
Welcome to Now Playing Podcast's bonus review of Nope.
You think whatever killed Pops is out there?
Hosted by Jacob, Arnie, and Stuart.
We need the shot.
What shot?
The shot. The money shot. The Oprah shot.
The Oprah shot?
This podcast is spoiler-filled and contains harsh language. Listener discretion is advised.
Holy hell.
We hope you enjoy the show.
You ready?
Mm-hmm. Are you ready?
Keep track of the visions in my eyes.
Today, we're discussing Nope, starring Daniel Kaluuya, Kiki Palmer, Steven Yeun, Michael Wincott, Brandon Perea, and Keith David for like 90 seconds, he gets an and. He should be an uncredited cameo. Directed by Jordan Peele. This is the Now Playing co-host, who's an animal ain't fit to be trained, Arnie.
And Stuart.
And in Now Playing's grand scheme, I'm always symbolized with the thimble. This is Jacob.
Hello, August patrons. And thank you for coming back. We've done it each time as an extra. It's sort of an unofficial series that we follow Jordan Peele's work, but Get Out was a October patron a few years ago, and then we did Us right before COVID hit. It was weird. I remember we put that show out, and like the next day, things were shutting down.
The thing, though, that hit me while working on my notes for this one, we've never covered him weekend of release before.
Right.
We covered Get Out when it had been out for a while. We covered Us around the time it hit video. I'm not sure that it's doing Nope any favors that I've only had a chance to see it once in theaters.
I was thinking that same thing because Get Out we did way after it came out, and I had seen that one a few times by then, and Us I saw theatrically, and then I got to watch it again. This, I got to go off of one take.
Oh, okay. I at least got two viewings in. I was happy about that. But yes, I knew that it was going to be a lot. You could tell that. When you saw this preview, there was just a lot of things going on that didn't feel like it all made sense together.
There was like UFOs and the history of black cinema. Yes, It's a lot.
You had to just trust the name. It really all comes down to Jordan Peele, we trust or don't. I don't know how you guys feel, but for me, it's very encouraging. Now, he has been working since Us in television. I don't know if you guys watched Lovecraft Country or he was Rod Serling for a bit in the new Twilight Zone.
I watched half an episode of that Twilight Zone and turned it off.
Yeah, not so much. Hunters, Al Pacino's first TV series. They were World War II assassins hunting down Nazis.
Heard great things about that. I didn't watch it, but people at my office can't stop talking about how good it is.
Yeah, I haven't watched his TV stuff, but if he's putting out a movie, I'm excited.
Yeah, maybe Candyman counts. I mean, he kind of put his name on the script. I feel like they used his name a lot.
Yes.
To promote that. It wasn't as good as the stuff that, you know, he didn't win an Oscar for that one. Let me just put it that way.
And as for revering Peele, Get Out is an amazing film that I like better every time I see it. Us, I was a little bit colder on Us. And the trailers for Nope, if we weren't reviewing it, I'd have waited for video at the very least. I am not so sold on the fact that Jordan Peele is making a movie that I'm going to watch it when the trailers tell me you're making an M. Night Shyamalan remake of Signs here.
I don't know if it looked like Signs, but it looked very messy. What was clear to me was they had no idea how to sell this movie. It looked sort of like a comedy and sort of like, yeah, Close Encounters. Very difficult to get a peg on tone.
I don't know. There are certain things aesthetically, is the way I'll put it, that will draw me into a film. And you tell me Jordan Peele is putting out a horror film called Nope. It takes me back. I think it was Edgar Wright's fake trailer for Don't. I don't know. There's something aesthetically just like a horror film with like a title like that. That is a draw to me.
Yeah. Well, like Get Out. I feel like his titles are kind of simple. I don't know if Nope is the perfect title for this movie. I don't know what you'd call this movie. There are so many elements in play.
They do say Nope a lot. I was trying to keep a tally.
I counted 7. I don't know what you got.
It got messy in my notes.
I didn't count, but I noticed it a lot, especially when it was just in the way you would think about it with a horror movie. Just you see something and nope, right out of there.
Yeah, but if you didn't have affinity for Jordan Peele, I don't know what you would make of this. The poster tells you it's a cloud with a trail of kites coming out of it. The TV spots make it look like a comedy with UFOs. I guess Universal Studios has created Jupiter's Claim. You can go and play around in the Western theme park. Maybe if you like Westerns, that will appeal to you. But again, how you sell this as a summer movie, I don't know. But the fact that it is a summer movie, and the biggest movie that Jordan Peele has made, I think is important. Because I think the movie thematically is all about that.
When you say biggest, do you mean in box office so far, or do you mean in budget?
Budget.
Okay.
Yeah, he got $60 million for this. Get Out was made for $3 million.
And I gotta ask, this was all post-COVID? Because, oh boy, when we get to Fry's, I was so confused, because Fry's ain't around anymore. It died because of COVID.
It was greenlit and cast and ready to go right before March of 2020. And so it took another year before they started filming, and another year before we got it.
I did enjoy the little trivia that was floating around, though. I think what the connection, maybe the studio is trying to make through social media, or maybe it's just a random observation, but that the third movie goes to space. You get Spielberg, and if you don't count Sugar Land Express, his third film, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. George Lucas's third film, Star Wars. M. Night had Signs.
If you don't count that Nun movie with Rosie O'Donnell.
And now Jordan Peele, if you don't count Candyman, his third film, is again going to Aliens. So that's kind of what I had going in, is Jordan Peele possibly this decade Spielberg?
No, he feels much more Kubrickian at times. I don't feel like Spielberg is his reference when he's doing stuff.
Oh, in this movie, I'll disagree with you.
In this one, yes, but I think of Jordan Peele, I don't think Spielberg.
Agreed. I think what's unique about Jordan Peele is that, A, he comes from a stand-up comedy and sketch comedy background, and yet he's got a dark side and a serious side.
He loves horror.
Yeah, and the fact that he has essentially asserted he's not leaving the horror genre behind. Because he's gotten respectable and got an Oscar, some people will take that as a cue of time to make my Oscar bait, and I can go make serious films. And he loves this genre, and he wants to elevate it. I think that's why I'm such a fan of him, is that he just wants to make better horror movies rather than taking this acclaim and going to make, yeah, other things. You know, Kubrick only made one horror movie. So this is like getting The Shining every time he makes a film. But how's it doing? I think it opened pretty well, $50 million or so.
Yeah, opening below your budget these days is never good. But for this film, I'd think a $50 million opening is something that should be applauded. I know that when I saw it, it was a Tuesday night, and I guess most of the people going to my non-IMAX showing said nope, because it was pretty sparse, but there was a family of seven that was in there and very vocal. Let me know what they thought of the movie nonstop. And it was seven, all mostly adults, young adults to old adults.
I saw this on a Monday night, so small crowd, there's maybe 15, 20 of us, but yeah, there was a woman that definitely let me know when she was scared.
I saw it Saturday afternoon, and then just a few hours ago, both IMAX showings. And yes, today, nobody there, but then again, who goes to a movie at 4 o'clock on Thursday? Except people that have to podcast about that said movie in 3 hours. But again, tough sell. It's a tough time right now just getting people back to movie theaters, by and large. If you don't have name recognition, and then, yeah, a weird-looking film that it's difficult to know what it's going to be.
Yeah, and I feel like this is the first time that the critics weren't all loving it, too. I felt like I came across quite a few headlines where they're like, maybe he doesn't have it. Maybe he is not the miracle that we thought he was.
Yeah, nobody was saying nope, but you definitely feel like there was, the way I read it, and I don't typically read reviews anymore, particularly before I'm about to review something myself, it seemed that people were confused. They weren't sure what to make of it. And so that's fun for me. That gets me excited to think, okay, just as Us was, just as Get Out was, maybe even more so, This is a movie that's going to need to be unpacked. We're not going to just talk about how we feel about it. We're going to try to decode it.
I am looking forward to that because I can't say I was confused, but I can say that if you unpack something, you're going to surprise me because I don't feel there's a lot of there.
Oh.
Yeah, I definitely have a thesis statement for this film, but it's the details and how we get there for me.
Oh, yeah, I know. I definitely think there's something there in the subtext, for sure. But let's talk about it. Arnie, give him the plot, and we'll get into Nope.
Hollywood horse trainer OJ, played by Daniel Kaluuya, is having a string of misfortune. He isn't as successful running the business as his father was. He can't even get full support from his sister Emerald, or Em, played by Kiki Palmer. Former child star come TV producer Jupe, played by Steven Yeun, has repeatedly offered to buy the horse business, but OJ is holding out. OJ and Em see a chance to turn their luck around when a strange alien ship flies over their farm. They hire Fry's tech Angel, played by Brandon Perea, to install security cameras all over their ranch, certain that photographic proof of alien life will make them rich. The problem is, when the alien ship flies overhead, everything on the ground loses power. The cameras are unable to get a clean shot. During all this, OJ starts to realize the saucer-shaped flying object isn't a ship, but is an alien itself. When Jupe brings together an audience to watch it emerge, the alien uses a vacuum-like power to suck everyone into its hole and eat them, Jupe included. But like an animal, OJ realizes the alien, who they've nicknamed Jean Jacket, only attacks you if you look at it. If you keep your eyes down, it leaves you alone. Still stuck on making their fortune, the siblings call on renowned cinematographer Antlers Holst, played by Michael Wincott. Holst arrives to film the alien with a hand crank camera that won't be stopped by the laws of electricity. However, seeing the alien, Holst runs out into the open and is eaten by Jean Jacket, and his camera is lost. Jean Jacket then starts to go after M, but OJ tries to lead the alien away by riding a horse and making the creature give chase. The creature goes back after M, who's made it to Jupe's ranch. She lets loose a large balloon mascot, which Jean Jacket tries to eat. The explosion of air from the popping balloon blows a hole in Jean Jacket, seemingly killing the alien. But M got her photo. She was able to take a picture of the alien while it was still alive thanks to a Polaroid machine on Jupe's ranch. She watches the picture come into focus as credits roll.
And you didn't even mention the best part, the opening. This monkey on a sitcom set.
That is truly the most horrifying thing in this movie, is the bloody monkey.
Yeah, these opening credits, and you hear like the canned laughter that you would expect in a sitcom, and yeah, as you, it's revealed, it's not a big long scene, but yeah, there's a body there and a monkey. Sorry, I believe it's an ape. I'll correct myself there. And yeah, no audience there. Something very scary has happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the fact that he's wearing the birthday hat and it's bloody all over his face, and then he kind of turns and looks at us, seemingly straight at us. This is a computer job, like Planet of the Apes. This is an actor that performed this. They didn't actually train a monkey to murder.
Yeah, some of those movements looked a little human. And I guess I'm starting to see with Peele, like, we've had animals. We had a deer, we had rabbits, now we got this chimpanzee. I don't remember if there was a biblical verse in Get Out, but this one also has a biblical verse like us in the beginning.
Yeah, this is where I really feel like you should pick up on what he's getting at with this movie. The fact that he starts with the Book of Nahum.
It's way back in the Old Testament.
It's Old Testament. It encompasses Jonah and the whale,
yes,
which I think is very important. The idea of a man being swallowed by a giant fish. We're going to get a lot of Jaws in this movie. We're going to talk a lot about consumption and being eaten. And the quote is, "I will cast you with abominable filth. I will make you vile and make you a spectacle." That, I think, is... Well, the book is about God's judgment, but it's also about the act of, yes, creating spectacle. And I do believe this movie is very postmodern in the way that it talks about cinema and the summer movie blockbuster in general. It is the monster of this movie. That's what I'll propose.
I took it a little more general. I would call this, again, my thesis title would be Doom Scrolling the Movie. Like, yeah, it's about spectacle and getting sucked in with just something else that's awful and ugly and how it affects you.
I really think that there is a criticism, really, about what has become of entertainment, what we make of entertainment, how we take real tragedy and turn it into profitable commercial entertainment. all of those themes run throughout here.
I definitely see that with the chimpanzee stuff, but we'll be getting to that later on. Right now, it's just an ominous opening.
Well, next we get to put a nickel in the Nickelodeon, only in this case, it's falling from the sky and going through the right eye of Keith David. That's how this movie really is starting on this movie ranch.
And knowing what movie I'm seeing, I see something pelting from the sky. I'm like, okay, what kind of alien thing is this? Is this a hailstorm being caused by an alien? And we're going to see it's just a bunch of falling crap. Pocket stuff. Keys, coins.
Yeah, the nickel is symbolic. But what you hear on the radio as we start here, that father and son are going about feeding their horses on the horse ranch, there's a radio talk about hikers in the area that have gone missing. So I can only presume that this is their detritus. This is all the stuff that they were carrying with them. Maybe they should have had a backpack come down here. But yes, this is the unedible parts of people in the local area being spat down onto this horse ranch and taking out Otis Sr. very quickly. Just that he's bragging that he's having a comeback and will be in some kind of sequel.
Yeah, Keith David's done wrong here. I love that actor, one of my favorites, going way back. And I was hopeful when I saw his name in the credits that he would be a bigger part of this movie, even though I didn't see him much in the trailers. The trailers were pretty enigmatic. So to see him killed here very quickly, I was like, okay, so maybe Jordan Peele just really wanted to work with Keith David briefly? I don't know, but it was a shock to me that he died so quick.
Again, the idea that entertainment is blood. The idea that you pop a nickel in a machine. We're going to see those kinds of machines throughout the amusement park we go to. Let's just kill him right here for our entertainment. He's talking about that. He's saying that we got to execute. We got to keep our heads out of the cloud when we get this next gig. They're a horse ranch in trouble. They're having to sell off all of their valuable horses. There's almost nothing left to the lustrousness of what is going on here. But they are, in fact, cinematic royalty. They can trace their roots all the way back to the first moving image, the great-great-grandfather who was caught on a hand crank camera.
Or do they? Is this all making something up to try to sell herself? Because she does everything. This feels like a very rehearsed speech. This is a movie, yeah, about how films can exploit other animals or, I guess, people as well. So I don't know if what she's saying is actually true or if this is a way to keep getting work in Hollywood.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, I'll take it at his word that they at least believe it. We'll see later. She's playing a video and her dad is also saying it. So generationally, the story has been passed down. I'll believe it. I mean, we don't know. I just want to put it out there. This is historically accurate. Edward Maybridge did invent the hand crank camera in the 1870s and was asked by a rich man to go out and film his horse. And it just so happened to be being ridden by an unknown black jockey. They've invented this identity, but it had to be somebody. And so the movie takes the interesting tack that this is the last remnants of the beginning of film. And how will they reinvent themselves? How will they be meaningful in a world where Westerns aren't popular and their horses are being sold off? And yes, they're on a commercial shoot. The horse is having to be tricked out with tape and freaks out when the 3D lighting ball gets put in its face.
Which I thought that was funny that they had the little pieces of tape on him so they could line him up with the CGI later.
Mm-hmm.
It's tricky when you do art about art, a film about film, because I don't know, all these interactions, the first act of this film is really hard for me to get into. It feels very clunky starting off, and all these observations about a Hollywood set feel very surface level, like stuff that I would probably come up with and not someone that's actually spent time with real sleazy Hollywood producers.
Really? I didn't know what this ball was. I had to look it up.
Oh, you didn't? I knew as soon as they turned it around, the horse was going to see itself and kick.
Yeah.
I'm saying I didn't know what it was. In a 3D movie shoot, this is what you actually use to get lighting levels for the entire area. I've never seen one.
Yeah, I knew all that.
Yeah, not even 3D, just anything where you're using CGI.
Yeah.
Okay, you guys knew something I didn't. I thought that this was very insider. In fact, I worried it was maybe too insider for people that don't know LA and the movie industry.
Jordan Peele could really balance the drama and the horror and the humor. And I feel like Kaluuya, he is so reserved in this. It's hard for me to ever get into his character. And the opposite side is Emerald, who is just so out there. I don't know. I'm not getting a funny vibe, like with that sleazy family with Tim Heidecker and Us and all that. It's hard for me to warm up to this brother and sister right away.
I agree. The sister doesn't even seem to care about the history with horses. She's out there pimping that she'll act and do all these other services. And OJ is such a laconic character that I have a real hard time warming up to him throughout this entire movie. Daniel Kaluuya is an actor who I think is very good, just so amazing in Get Out, and decent enough in Black Panther. He wasn't given much to do, but fine. And here, I think he's acting tremendously. I think he's giving a great performance, but it's a performance of a character that is not that easy to warm up to. There's no save the cat moment with this guy, you know? You just have to hope you go with his story of being down on his luck as enough to give you empathy for this character, because he's not going to be funny. He's not going to do a lot of talking. He's not going to really win you over.
It is a real risk to make the central character so withdrawn. I mean, Daniel Kaluuya is our greatest under actor. I mean, he did literally win the Oscar last year for being very tamped down. And usually most of his performances, I don't see him doing big. I can't see him doing mainstream comedy. It is a funny performance sometimes, but it's funny because he's deadpan.
Yeah, when he finally says nope later on, like, that is funny because that's the most he ever says, really.
But the point is that this is a character that can't look him in the eye. He's on this movie set. He needs his sister to do the whole cheerleading bit because he's not a people person, and they're all staring at him. She's late. It's important to his character that he doesn't look people in the eye. That actually will be his saving grace.
And the sister is somewhat estranged. She shows up late. She's asking if she could crash at his place, but they obviously don't live together. Not even quite sure how often they see each other. It's, again, a real enigmatic relationship here that we're going to have as our central relationship for this whole movie.
I'll agree with you. It feels not exactly underdeveloped, but underexplained. And I do feel like there are teases in this movie where I guess we're invited to fill in the blanks, and those are really big gaps. I would say too big. I would want more of this. What we're told, the way I read it, is she wanted to be a part of this world, and her father, being sexist, gave the horse that was intended for her, Jean Jacket, to her brother, and he was the one that got to be on movie sets and have all of that that she wanted. And so she has removed herself from the horse ranch. She makes it clear, my side hustle isn't the other things that I was pimping. My side hustle is coming back and saving your ass and doing these kinds of commercial shoots because you're not really very good at it. And I wish that my dad had loved me enough to bring me into the business.
Yeah, I get all that throughout the film. By the end of it, I think I get the relationship, but at the beginning, it is very sparse, very minimal, and so I'm kind of left confused and feeling left behind, and that was my frustration during this first act.
And I'm not quite sure where the horse Jean Jacket ends up landing, because she makes it sound like they went off and had this great Hollywood adventure, and he's like, no, we went to shoot Scorpion King, and they didn't even use the horse, they ended up using camels. So it sounds like nobody won in that story.
Yes. In the brother's mind, it wasn't that big a deal. You didn't miss out. But to her, what she's holding on to is that I was unloved. I was excluded. I've had to make my own way in the Hollywood circuit. And so there's resentment there. And whether this is the story that will properly dramatize how these two wayward siblings come together, probably not. I feel like this is not the most important thing we're here to talk about. But that is sort of the relationship here. And as she's doing her cute little spiel, I do think that Kiki Palmer is more fun to watch just because she is animated. Some of the things she's saying are important cues about the movie itself. What are her rules for safety? No loud noises. We're going to know that sets off chimpanzees. Tell something if you see something. We know that looking in the eye is a very big problem. And then when she's talking about all the things she can do, one of the things she really pushes is motorcycles. So they are teasing all of the craziness that's to come, but you wouldn't know it first viewing.
Well, I felt like the whole scene with the horse when he does kick because he sees his reflection, I'm like, okay, that's a very important scene to me. Like, I felt like that was really telling me what to expect later on when bigger things might pop out.
Yeah, Otis Jr. relates to this horse. He even says that they lack focus, that they're not able to, again, concentrate. And so, yeah, he's going to have to essentially sell this thing with the idea that eventually, somehow, he'll scheme to buy it back. But yes, the horse can't handle being on a movie set. He can't handle the spotlights, all the camera trickery. What movies have become, this horse can't handle anymore. Back in 1870s, when it was just a hand crank and a black jockey on it, no problems. But movies have gotten too elaborate. There feels like there's a criticism about today's movie making Jordan Peele is making throughout this movie, but I'll go with that.
Yeah, I did get a chuckle as they're leaving after they lost the job. They're wheeling in the all green horse prop for CGI.
Mm-hmm. Replace it by an entirely CGI creation.
Yeah.
Yes, I think that is criticism. That is Jordan Peele saying we're losing something by losing the live animal.
Ironically, this film is not about a live animal, though.
It's kind of alive.
Yeah.
Well, not a real one in real life that you could film without CG is what I mean.
Mm-hmm. I think it's an old one, but we'll talk about Lovecraft in a minute. Let's talk about Jupiter's Claim. Where he's going to sell Lucky the horse is a really sad tourist trap being run by a child star from a 90s Western show.
I was trying to figure out, because we'll see the Burbank Fries with that great UFO crashing into the building, and this horse ranch, and I guess Jupe's Claim, is out in Agua Dulce, which I had relatives live out there. There's nothing in Agua Dulce. It really is horse territory.
I was a little bit confused with Jupe, because when they go to see him, it does seem like he's working on some kind of television show, as well as running a theme park.
Here's what it is. It took me a second viewing to catch that. He is coasting on being Kid Sheriff. I don't remember any show like this in the 90s, but, you know, maybe it was kids' entertainment. That there was a Western themed, he was the little Asian kid that stole the scenes.
This is different than the chimpanzee sitcom,
yes,
though. Okay.
Yes, that was his celebrity, and then when that show collapsed, he was cast on this sitcom that has become notorious. And we can talk about why it's notorious, but what you might be talking about is when we walk through his office, we see a poster for Jupiter's Orbit, a new reality show, and you realize that he and his wife are actually trying to plan for a future reality show set at this park.
Okay.
The reasons why they think that they have something here is, of course, the fact that they believe that they can bring real-life aliens into the show.
Okay, that's what was going on. I was a little confused around there.
Again, things start making sense by the end, but when you go to this, yeah, real bad tourist trap, Western attraction, and there's all this UFO and alien dolls that you could buy as souvenirs, it's very strange when you're first watching it and trying to place everything.
You don't see that stuff at first. What he's doing right now is trying to bring in them with his celebrity and his notoriety, and then he's going to wow them with this thing that, yeah, he just found out about 6 months ago. But the alien stuff is not the selling point to this Jupiter's Claim yet. It's what they're planning on it being. I don't know if you noticed it, but also on his desk, a giant pair of scissors that must have been from Us. So there's some kind of linkage to the other. There is a Jordan Peele universe, but I think it's just an in-joke. But yes, the secret room of this place, if you get past Kid Sheriff, is the fact that in 1996, he was cast in a show that doesn't feel like it's from 1996. It feels like it's from 1982.
Yeah, definitely had a Small Wonder vibe.
This is my same problem with BoJack Horseman, if you watch that on Netflix. They tell me there was a sitcom in the 90s about a horse dad taking care of human kids. That wasn't Full House. That's no Danny Tanner.
Maybe it was on the WB. I mean, they did have Homeboys in Outer Space. So, like, there was really bad programming, that kind of cheesy stuff. But TV was actually getting better in the late 90s. And the fact that this would have been on the air, not likely. Gordy's Home would have been a syndicated show or a Nickelodeon show. Again, the way that it looks, what I can tell, piecing it together, it looks like the story of a rocket scientist who adopted an Asian kid and kept the space chimp from the capsule, and they all live together in the same household. And that feels like the kind of wacky ALF plot that's popular a decade prior.
It's more 80s, I agree.
Yeah.
Different Strokes, ALF, I'll just call it out. They should have cast an older actor and made it an 80s show, but Steven Yeun is kind of having a moment now. He's had several successful seasons of Walking Dead and got an Oscar nomination for Minari, so he gets the role. And he's pretty good here when he finally gets to talking about the real reason why people might want to talk to him and see his secret room. Yeah, it's kind of spooky stuff when he opens up that panel and talks about Gordy's home and the special season 2 episode of his birthday.
Though it's still really just hinted at what happened. We saw that opening scene at the beginning, and now, yeah, we're going to see a shoe and a Mad Magazine. We'll see some of the things he kept, but we still don't know the whole story. But it's something that people are willing to pay, what, $50,000 to spend the night in that room?
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. Even though you might come here because it's a Western theme park, and I was a bit player on this show, truly, and I think this is a thesis of this, it's the idea of the blood. It's the idea that real-life murder makes things more interesting these days. The reality behind the story. The fact that he was touched by this notorious on-screen massacre in which a chimpanzee went totally nuts and defaced and killed cast members, that lives on. That's what I love about the scene. We never see the moment in full. We have teases leading up to a very abstracted look at this monkey attack. But what Ricky really wants to focus on, what's really kind of interesting, is he is so traumatized by it, he would rather talk about the SNL parody of it and how good Chris Kattan is playing the chimpanzee killing his cast members than to actually go there and experience it again.
I was dying with the Chris Kattan references.
I mean, it makes sense. That's who would do it.
He was Mr. Peepers, so I could see him doing another ape-like character, but the way he's going, Kattan was just killing it and all of that. I'm like, oh man, knowing what I know about Kattan now, it's just kind of a little sad.
Yeah.
I don't know what that means. What about him now?
Oh, he broke his neck on a set of a film and...
On SNL.
Was it SNL? I thought it was Corky Romano.
I had heard Corky Romano, but then I saw him talk recently, and he said it was during an SNL sketch. He took a fall, broke his neck. All he wanted was for them to pay the medical bills, and they threatened to blackball him, and then he got on an opioid addiction. And now he's dating my wife's foot surgeon's ex-wife.
Okay.
Okay, I can't follow that train, but congratulations, I guess. The point is, this feels even more like I'm on the right track then. So what he's highlighting by mentioning the name Chris Kattan is that entertainment is bloody and that people get hurt in real ways trying to entertain you.
That is how I took this. And I think this part was really smart, the way that he won't talk about what happened and went into this SNL thing, which is funny at the same time. Like, this is where I start getting more into the film because, yeah, this character, he's got something tragic, but the way he goes about telling the story is very interesting and very telling about who he is.
He has to make it fun because that's why people pay to come here. And yet you can see we have a brief scene of cutback to chubby little kid version of him hiding under the table, blood spattered, and he's not having any fun at all. It's a hard thing for him to go back to, so he'd rather talk about the entertainment, the way that it was turned into a laugh, than to talk about the pain that it actually caused him. But yes, what he really wants to do is buy the land. And I'm not exactly sure why, except that he must be thinking, once this alien thing gets out, I'm going to have Disney World here. I'm going to own the whole thing and make it this giant UFO convention. This kind of passe movie ranch, nobody needs anymore. I'm the new idea of entertainment.
And so at this point, he's seen the alien.
Yes.
Yeah.
And is already planning for the whole reality show and everything around the alien that OJ hasn't even got a clue about yet.
Yeah, because he's going to pull a Scooby-Doo, I think, to try to scare OJ off his land by some people dressed up as aliens showing up on the ranch.
That may have just been the son's unmotivated. We could talk about that in a bit. I don't know if that was his scheme or not, but he definitely says, well, we will hear him reciting his lines, that for the last 6 months, he's been experiencing this wonderful spectacle. And so, yes, this is happening in September. So, yes, this is long before. Remember, the dad also was killed 6 months ago. So that was when the alien creature first showed up.
Yeah.
And ever since then, Ricky has been courting it, trying to train it, essentially. How do I tame this so that I can turn this monster into an amusement park attraction. But yes, you're right. Our main characters don't know. The audience doesn't know yet. All they know is there's an offer to sell this sad ranch. And I think Emerald will do it. Again, you can sense her bitterness. Why are we holding on to this? I barely come here. It's not happy memories for me. It's only because OJ is still wanting to live up to the ideals of his father and probably isn't really skilled at getting another kind of job. I don't know what else he would do that he's holding on.
But that leads us to the first instance with Jean Jacket, the alien. OJ is out working with one of the horses, and the horse gets spooked. It jumps right over the fence, goes running off. OJ is after it, and
it's Ghost. It's actually the horse that got the key in its ass that the dad was riding when he got killed. So it knows by hearing that sound exactly what's coming. It's not just generally spooked. It knows, oh no, here comes more debris flying at me.
Okay, I thought, you know, horses get spooked and know when earthquakes are happening before people.
Yeah.
So I didn't realize it was remembering the key in its ass.
Yeah, it knows the pain that's associated with that sound. And again, I want to really compliment Jordan Peele, whether you like this story or not, great filmmaker. Just the way that he'll use sound design in this, the way that they build mood. I don't know, Jacob, you say that this is a slow opening. Maybe it is, but I just love the way that we're slowly tiptoeing up to the secrets. I really think this stuff is compelling.
I mean, I agree. You want things to slowly be revealed. You want a mystery. I think it's a matter of just the characters. It's hard for me to get in with these characters where I get out and us. I was able to relate to those characters. This one, it's a little tougher.
I'll agree with Jacob. I have a real hard time with the first half hour of this movie. And if you don't look at it as just deconstruction, if you look at it from the plot of this movie, a lot of what goes on this first half hour really is irrelevant. All you're setting up plot-wise is these two people are down on their luck. And nothing with the horse kicking when it sees the reflective ball or anything like that ever comes into play.
Sure it does.
I mean, it sets up the whole eye thing, and that's how OJ knows not to look it in the eye.
He has that flashback later, but it just really feels tenuous. And yeah, this is a really slow opening that's neither funny, which I associate with Jordan Peele, nor scary, which I associate with Jordan Peele. I'm just right now happy when the alien starts getting involved in it, because what's happening, here's where I can really tell a transcendent movie of a genre and not, is Poltergeist. I like that family before the ghost hits. I like the father's remote control battles. Like with Nightmare on Elm Street 4, I'm interested in Alice and her brother outside of Freddy. I would watch a movie about Alice and her brother and their drunk father and their high school friends, period. And then Freddy comes into it and kind of takes away from that movie that I would enjoy. Here, I'm not jonesing to these people, and so I do not want the movie of them without an alien in it. So let's get the alien in it.
My other issue as we get on to the next part is I don't understand the time. We talked about the sitcom that feels more 80s than 90s. I'm looking at phones. OJ has a flip phone, so I'm like, is this 2006? But then we'll see M with a smartphone. And the fact that their plot is, this feels so 90s. We got to get footage of a UFO. Now look, if someone got real footage of a UFO, that would be huge. But it just feels like we got to have our Oprah shot. And this feels weird that this is their plan to get rich and get out of their problems is to maybe film a UFO and sell that footage for $100,000.
Well, they do need some kind of miracle. They are down on their luck. And the horse, it was the second best horse he had. And he freaked out on a modern movie set. So they really can't train these horses and bring them on to modern movies anymore. They don't have a means of making this ranch work anymore. So this is the gift. If we get this footage, then we save our ranch. And I think that that's for OJ, that's what he's working towards. It's not because he really even cares about the UFO, strangely enough. If anything, he's resentful. He was told that his father was killed by junk that was dropped out of like a crop duster or something like that. Some private plane flew by and that must have been what killed him. And he never believed that. So this night that Ghost the horse goes missing, he sees something move in those clouds. It's kind of like the shark fin in Jaws. I definitely feel like were to think of the sky as the ocean in Jaws. He believes that he might be able to get the creature, the alien, that killed his dad.
I get the Jaws reference. I guess with Jaws, you're putting together this team throughout the film so they can get on a boat and fight that shark and get it. And it's weird as they start to assemble their team here. They go to a Fry's, which again is out of business. It was really struggling before COVID. They were mostly empty. So this was probably a cheap location. I know why they want it, like this Burbank location. I don't know if you ever went there, Stuart, but giant UFO on the outside, inside.
I remember it, yeah.
Yeah, they had like army guys fighting aliens. Every Fry's had a different theme. But no Fry's employee is this friendly. And I thought it was funny on the goofs on IMDb. They're like, there is always a line at Fry's to wait in. Like, they just walk up and this, like, if you don't buy their in-store warranty, they get very unfriendly. Like, he didn't even try to sell that. But the fact that, oh, yeah, I'll go out there and install all this, it doesn't feel natural. It feels almost cartoony to me, the way they're going to put this group together.
Yeah, especially this character from Fry's just seems like the comic relief. And yet, he's my favorite character in this movie because he has personality that goes a long way.
Yeah.
But yes, I had to wonder if this Fry's thing was a paid product placement.
They're not around anymore. There's no one to pay.
No, but they were still around when this movie was greenlit.
No. I think that this movie is filled with detritus, of remnants of things that get forgotten and thrown away.
Yeah.
Like the entertainment consumption, the idea that it just gets spit out and thrown away. Fry's is the bone of yesterday's electronics. I mean, again, you'll see so many references, like she's wearing a t-shirt from Prince's Love Sexy Phase.
Jesus Lizard shirt.
Yeah, all of these things that seemed important in the moment that have truly just become garbage, just litter on the ground. I see that as a real theme of this movie. They could have gone with Best Buy. They definitely could have gotten paid to have something that's still in business.
But there's no Best Buy with a UFO in it.
Yeah, but they wanted to remind us of something from our recent past.
I didn't even know Fry's was out of business, so that was lost on me.
Yeah, I don't know where they are in other states, but in Southern California, like, Fry's, you want to go to Fry's. It was always fun.
And Angel, yes, he's Richard Dreyfuss. He's the expert that's going to blow in here. They know that they need to get a great money shot that they can take to Oprah Winfrey, and he's the only guy that really knows how to do that. And so you have this kind of uncomfortable scene where they're telling him that they've been robbed. He's setting up the cameras, and then they're like, keep pointing it up. He's like, wait, what? And they just keep pointing it up to the sky. You know no robbers are coming from the sky. Eventually, he's just like, you know they don't call them UFOs anymore. They're UAPs.
I thought that was very reminiscent of that scene from the opening of Close Encounters, where I think they're in India and all the people are chanting. They're like, where did they hear this noise? And they all like raise their finger into the sky. I thought that was a good scene. Like, no, keep moving it up more.
Yeah, that was a fun scene. And like I said, with him in the film, it definitely picks up a little bit in terms of humor, in terms of just engaging character interactions.
I mean, I don't believe that a Fry's employee would, like, be this concerned.
No, he's a UFO conspiracist. He's not doing this out of the love of his company. He's going to stay after work, unpaid, to watch the video feed, because these guys are up to something and they're not telling him what it is.
Yeah, it's hard for me to buy this relationship, but I'll go with it because I like this actor and what he's doing with the Angel character.
Here's what I would say. It feels like these elements aren't melding together.
Correct.
Completely, I don't want to use the word coherent because I think I understand the story, but they don't all fit together nicely. The pieces don't snap together.
It doesn't feel as well thought out as his other two films. I didn't have issues like this with Get Out or Us. I'm drawn in by those characters and I don't feel like pacing or things aren't gelling together like I do with this film.
Agreed.
Yeah, I'll just go ahead and say it's less successful than those other two movies. Because I do feel like there's been a lot of creative free thought. Let's just improvise. Let's throw elements together and see if they play well together.
It's George Lucas. It's like jazz.
In a bit. I do feel like there are several ideas that are coming to play as opposed to everything being of the same piece. And so maybe that works for you. Maybe you like the chaos. I tend to think that this is a very broad stroke to bring Angel in this way, complaining about the girlfriend that ran off to be in a CW show. But yeah, I saw that the audience was responding to him. And I do think the main characters are tougher to understand and like, even though I think they're good. And I think they would work maybe in a different movie better.
Maybe they would if you had more surrounding them. Here we bring in Angel, but if we had other family members or, you know, she talks about having a boyfriend, doesn't she?
A girlfriend.
A girlfriend, okay. And to have those people interact as well would be interesting. Do you guys appreciate this motive of theirs, though, that there's an alien above their head and they want the Oprah money?
That's what I was saying. This feels like a 90s thing. Like, look, the government put out all their documents about UFOs and no one cares except that guy from Blink 182 that's really into UFOs. We just don't care. We all have phones in our pocket. Mm-hmm. We're not capturing the UFOs like we did in the 80s and 90s anymore.
No, and that their entire motivation is money, and not money to get mom the operation she needs, but money because they're just too stubborn to sell the horse ranch that they could probably sell for a lot of money. And then you just have to go with the thought that a photo of aliens are actually going to sell when the photo of Bigfoot has been so debunked. It's so easy to fake a photo these days.
Well, okay. I hear what you're saying is that I'm not buying the premise. Okay, maybe, maybe not.
No, I'm asking if you guys are. I'm certainly not.
It feels clunky to me is what I'll say.
I hear two different motives. For the son, again, he's very serious. He's trying to honor a tradition that goes all the way back to the dawn of filmmaking. So for him, this is about next level, taking that rudimentary filmmaking and actually filming the impossible. For him, he is continuing the traditions of his father and his great-great-great-great-grandfather. And that's why he's doing it. I think that makes sense. That tracks. For her, who doesn't feel connected to this ranch and who just sort of is trying to catch work where she can, trying to get fame where she can, it is much more like a pipe dream. It doesn't feel like that would be true. When she's saying, oh, you're going to get $100,000 for this, I'm going, no, you're not. But you're not a realistic character. You're just kind of hustling.
I don't know how many horses they have. I do know horses are expensive.
Right. And yeah, he sold 10. And when you see that opening, there's not many hay bales left. So I don't feel like there's much more than 5 or 6 left when we see shots of them. And we get them next because we have another alien encounter that ends up being a fool you moment, as Jacob talked about.
I will say, though, they got me because I'm waiting for something to scary happen. We've seen some UFO shots in the clouds, but like, yeah, that we see these bodies crawling around and then we see like the top of a head and it just slowly starts poking out. Reminded me of that slow reveal of that trash man dude in Mulholland Drive, where it's the slow reveal that's scarier than the fast one. But yeah, it ends up being a joke.
Yeah, the family behind me, when they saw that first one that was crouched there that just looked like a shadow and then it started moving, they were like, oh shit. And then when it became a joke, they were just cracking up.
Yeah, and I think it's part of OJ's character that he has a flip phone. He didn't update. He's not so into the modern. Like, that's part of the problem.
Yeah, they still got the record player that M's always rocking out to at the house.
Right, yeah, he's retro in a way. He's living in the tradition of what his family did at the start, back in 1870. You know, that's, in his mind, that's my values. And so, yeah, he doesn't need a new phone. He doesn't need all of that stuff. It's actually good because that's, I think, the stance that Peel is taking as well, is that we, as a culture, in trying to go for bigger and bigger, have gotten more heartless, have gotten more bloody, have gotten more dehumanized.
I have such a problem with that idea, though. But, okay, I do think he's getting at something about what we put in front of our face, but that almost comes off as a little too puritanical for me.
Yeah, it's definitely Luddite. It's definitely saying, I mean, the fact that this all is going to be done with a hand crank IMAX camera, while it's actually being presented in IMAX to me, feels like an irony that I think sometimes Peele is aware of and maybe sometimes isn't. It's a curious thing to unpack. That's what I'm always thinking about, is how serious is his message about audience hunger for bigger and better?
And I go back to Key and Peele, his sketch comedy show, where, yeah, it was usually humorous, but every once in a while he'd go into, like, surreal horror territory. So I think he's very aware, and I don't know, maybe he could use some more judicial editing, not in actually the way the film was cut. Well, he could have done that too. I could have used 20 minutes less, but just what you're presenting. I think he's got a lot of ideas in this film, reading people's theories, what this is about, everything from grief to animal abuse to the movie industry. Like, there's a lot of stuff going on in here, and I think you got to tighten it up a little bit.
Maybe, or maybe you just come back to the movie in a year. Again, we've had the luxury of being able to do that in the past, and we don't. We have to go off on first impressions, and so that's the struggle.
I agree.
What I agree with, what you guys are saying, is this one isn't as fun to watch as the previous two. Rather, it will end up being just as profound. It isn't as entertaining.
And thus, its message, even if it is as profound, will forever be muted by those who don't wish to return to it.
Right. If that's the case. I just want to put it out there. I'm enjoying this. But yes, I can recognize already that this isn't of the same piece as the other two.
Here's the thing. I'm enjoying certain scenes. There are certain ones that I think are brilliant and then other ones that feel very mundane. It's not an even piece for me.
Yeah. I feel like for me, whenever they try to get too big with the comedy, like M going and stealing the plaster horse and all of that, and then trying to snow Ricky when he comes trying to get it back, that didn't play for the laughs that they were trying to do. You may not have even realized that she stole it from him because it's such a brief shot of the beginning of Jupiter's claim and seeing that horse.
And let me pay this movie a big compliment because I feel like I've been complaining about it. Stuart, you're going into the details of what it's about and I'm enjoying hearing your thoughts on that. But I do want to say this is a gorgeous looking film.
Yes.
It's out there on a California ranch. There's all of these wide shots of landscape and the sky there. And when you do get a glimpse of that alien with the clouds and just the clouds themselves, this film is so well shot. I agree with you. Peele is a tremendous craftsman.
Agreed.
How could you not enjoy this scene of the horse getting sucked up into that cloud and then that? It reminded me of Charlie Brown. Remember the tree that ate the kite?
Yes.
Just seeing that tail of flags hanging out of that cloud is such a brilliant, surrealistic image. It's just something I would like as a painting of just a cloud with a tail.
I mean, you could have it. It's the poster for this film, or one of the posters is a cloud with that tail hanging out.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And we get another note here as well that he's seeing those fake aliens. Walking away from that, we realize that it's actually Ricky's sons playing a prank for stealing that plaster horse. They've let out one of his horses, and that gets eaten here. His name's Clover. And Angel reveals himself to be a peeper. He is not honoring what they asked and not looking at their feed. He's calling and telling M that she should get the praying mantis off of camera A.
I feel like here's a real suspenseful scene where you want to get that shot of the UFO, but there's that bug on there. And as someone, I've had security cameras outside around our house and bugs flying them all the time. Like, that's what sets off the motion alarm the most, usually.
Yeah, and I briefly thought the aliens looked like praying mantises.
I thought maybe that's what was going to be a reveal. I'm there with you.
Well, let's just talk about it. The classic alien is the gray, right?
Yes.
The little green or gray thing with the bug eyes. That does look like an insect creature. We're preparing for what's going to be inside this flying saucer. If it's such a traditional flying saucer look, then it's going to be traditional aliens. The big gambit will hold on to it, but basically we're going to find out we're looking at the creature. It is saucer-shaped. It is not containing life. It is life. But I think there are a lot of games being played, and I'm not as comfortable as you guys saying they need to cut them all out. I'm wanting to figure them out. I feel one game that's being played on here is we get just a lot of references to celebrities that have had tragedies. For example, the main character is named OJ, and we have this moment, and she's like, run, OJ, run. And when she says that, I immediately think about OJ Simpson and those commercials where he had to, you know, well, he ran for football, of course, but also my reference, I don't watch football, but he did all of those Avis or Hertz commercials where he had to run through airports or whatever. And I just thought, again, that is Jordan Peele talking about the way that murder and blood can intertwine with our cheesy entertainment.
And all I thought of was Run, Forrest, Run. I didn't even think of OJ.
Yeah, I'm there with you.
No, the fact that he's called OJ, I think, is that wasn't an accident.
Well, yeah, you talk about a spectacle that we all watched. OJ running in the white Bronco, the trial, all of that.
Yeah. And I feel like later there's a song being sung by Jodie Foster, who, of course, was the target of Hinckley. I feel like there is some kind of Da Vinci Code about celebrity, reality, all that blur, all of that TMZ noise. I feel like is sprinkled throughout here that I'm trying to figure out. The other thing I'm trying to figure out is notice a lot of the characters are tied with letters. The horse had X's all over it, and OJ wears an X, and Emerald is called M all the time. I was trying to figure out what it might all spell, but I couldn't in two viewings figure it out. But I'm quite sure that there is a game with letters being played.
Because people knew this was kind of a UFO movie from the trailer, and it's called Nope, people were like, oh, that really means not of planet Earth. So yes, when you go see a Jordan Peele film, people want to decode it.
But yes, getting back to the movie that I'm watching here, we're, about 30 minutes into this movie. We see the fake plaster horse go up in the cloud. Then we see the real horse get eaten as well. And this is where our main character, OJ, is starting to make the connections about what he's facing. He's like, maybe this isn't a ship. Maybe it's acting territorial. He has a flashback with his dad saying, some animals aren't fit to be trained, and he's making that link that this is behaving like a horse, like a wild horse, and not like a flying saucer. This is also where we get our Robert Shaw of the movie. Antlers Holst, played by Michael Wincott, is the celebrity DP from the commercial shoot at the beginning of the movie. When they realize they can't use a bunch of Fry's cameras to get the Oprah shot, they want this decorated cinematographer to do it.
And this guy has such a wonderful voice, and I've seen him in so many things, but here, he's a real standout, and he just seems so uninterested at first. You know, he's editing bugs fighting, I think it is.
No, they're all predators. They're all like apex predators. There's lizards.
Yeah, there's like a tiger versus an anaconda or something at one point.
What he says is, I do one for them and one for me. He goes and makes those cheesy commercials with Donna Mills, and then he says, I do one for me. And he's at the Steenbeck putting together some obscure animal documentary no one would ever watch.
It is telling, like, when they try to get him, and they're like, we're doing a reality show. And he's like, nope.
Nope.
I'm too good for that. Oh, it's a documentary. Then he gets interested.
Which, again, I think Jordan Peele makes a distinction about that as well. That the documentary has been perverted into sort of this superficial, sensationalized, exploitative medium that is lesser.
You think he's criticizing Tiger King?
I didn't say anything in particular, but yes, I feel there is a cultural judgment that began right from that biblical quote about spectacle. And Holst is saying no. At this point, what he's saying is, although it's tempting to say you want me to film the impossible, maybe he doesn't like the fact that they don't have any money. Maybe he doesn't like the memory that he has of her, but maybe he's just a weird dude that says cryptic things like, this is a dream you never wake up from when you go to the top of the mountain and all eyes are on you. But that is prophetic words for the way he ends up.
Yeah, because he says that's the life he lives, or the dream he lives, is because he's such a famed cinematographer. I guess he's tired of people coming after him to film their shit.
Yeah, he wants to film the impossible, and again, there's imagery of standing on the top of the mountain, all eyes on you. Eyes, obviously, are the big theme here. And Angel has had his eyes on the camera footage and figured out through time-lapse photography that there is one cloud on the horizon that ain't moving. I thought this was cool.
Yeah, that was clever, like watching all this footage and the one cloud that's just there the whole time. That's weird.
It's been there for 6 months. They can go back and they can, again, tracing everything back to that day that that father died. It was the day that this thing arrived. And ever since then, Ricky has been courting it. And we finally get some answers, as much as we're going to get, about the 1998 rampage of Gordy.
Can I say, best scene of the film?
Yes.
It's not my favorite, but I like it.
Oh, okay. It connects because it's going to explain a character, but it does feel like a darling that could be cut, but I'm glad it's not. This is the scene where, like, a woman in the theater, as that chimpanzee approaches Gordy, she's like, oh, no, screamed it like she was worried.
I like it just because it's unexpected, and it is just so evocative. Again, just the surrealism of seeing a chimpanzee with a birthday hat on and blood all over his face glaring at us.
That woman's body laying there, and then when the sitcom dad comes out and it chases it off stage into that room and you just hear it killing him, it is a gruesome scene.
The sound effects here.
Yeah.
The squishing.
You don't see the violence, but yeah, you hear it.
And I really thought that that little girl was dead, right? I mean, the one that's right next to the chimp. But he just kept beating on her and beating on her.
Yeah.
And I kept thinking about, I'm sure most people have heard of the true story about the lady who has the chimpanzee, and her friend came over wearing a hat one day, and the chimpanzee ripped that woman's face off.
Yep.
And that's all I'm thinking about is this little girl had her face ripped off or something like that.
So here's my question, because we're told it's balloons that set off Gordy.
Mm-hmm.
We are going to get a shot of this shoe that is standing upright. And so I thought, I'm like, oh, somehow that alien spaceship is over this studio. That's what's actually driving the chimpanzee crazy, because it feels like it can manipulate matter around it. So like the fact that this shoe is standing up, I don't know what that means. I guess there was no alien there, but that's what I thought Peele is trying to tell us.
Never occurred to me. I love the idea. You'll have to fill me in when you see it again, how the aliens were there in 1998. I didn't read it that way.
How do you read the shoe that's standing up magically?
Again, I just think that it's one of those details that remains frozen in time. We first saw it in a glass case that he had in his back room to talk about it. And you wonder, why is there a shoe with blood? And now we're seeing that, yeah, it fell off this girl after she got knocked over. And it's just sort of this weird miracle.
Well, yeah, they have this idea of bad miracles in the film. Was that a bad miracle because it came about because of this chimpanzee murdering people?
I mean, have you ever had that experience where you're in a really strange moment and you see something unusual? I don't know how else to put it, but yeah. American Beauty tried to symbolize the moment as like a bag floating in the wind. There can just be kind of a strangeness that can occur in the middle of chaos that you just kind of hold on to. And that's the way I took it, is that it was just probably part of the lore of this often discussed moment. All the tell-all books, the Mad Magazine, the SNL probably all talked about the shoe.
And again, I think you could probably cut this scene and you wouldn't lose much, but I think the point of it is to explain Ricky. He thinks he had this encounter with the chimpanzee where it didn't attack him, and that's why he's got this mentality with Jean Jacket, the alien, that he could tame it somehow or it won't attack him because he survived this before.
I'm not even sure about that. So let's unpack that. Because yes, what we're told was that this Gordy chimp, there were several of them, and I do think it's a little bit odd. The scene's great, but it's a little bit odd that the trainer would have been on set, but like,
everyone's gone. Where did the audience go?
There's like two people in the audience cowering, not trying to hide, and the dad is trying to get away. I don't know what happened to the mom, just not even there. And yeah, the teenage daughter that brought the balloons, she's the one lying there on the ground. And we were told that the very first exploding fist bump happened on this show, and this monkey, while killing everyone else, seemingly, sees Ricky under the table and wants to do the exploding fist bump. Does not feel impelled to flip the table and hurt him in the same way. So maybe Ricky believes he has the gift of taming animals. That is kind of how I read it.
But what I was left wondering is after the fist bump, it's such a tense moment with that chimpanzee having just beaten those two people and then seeing this little boy, he comes up to do the exploding fist bump. But while I know, because we've seen him as an adult, that Jupe is going to get away, I'm still very nervous as what happens after that fist bump. Is it starting with a fist bump and ending with fists in his face? How does that go? He may believe he's an animal trainer, but really what happened is somebody shot that chimp in the head.
Yeah, animal control finally got there, security, and blew its head off.
I also think there's something else there about trauma. I feel like because he lived through this moment, he can't escape this moment. This moment is his whole life. He's built this whole park in some ways to exploit and explore this, and now he has an opportunity to go there again and get the answers about what happens next. So I do feel like, because of the way Steven Yeun plays it, the horror on his face, even as he's trying to sell this, sometimes you can see that there's real fear there. It's a compelling idea of what he's trying to do with this park. As we jump to the future, he's been telling everyone, come, press releases, Star Lasso experience. They get 40 people. For all of that, nobody is going out to that.
You know how far out Agua Dulce is? I'm surprised this Fry's dude from Burbank's going out there every day.
Yeah.
Let me just say, in the feeding frenzy that is everything that goes on in LA, if somebody's inviting you to something, it's not someplace you want to go. I get so many review requests for films for now playing to do, but none of them are ones that we have on our schedule to do.
We could have done all those geezer teasers with Bruce Willis, I'm sure.
Yeah, they're doing you a favor by promoting themselves. Yes, that's typically how it works. Which is not to say that those films aren't great. I wouldn't know. I'm not watching them.
They're not.
Exactly. But what it comes down to is everybody's trying to shoot upward. We're doing the same thing when we reach out to people for interviews and things. We're shooting upward, and 99 times out of 100, the answer is going to be no answer whatsoever. And that's what happens to Jupe with this, is some people show up, but not very many.
Yeah, I feel like he got the locals, and that's probably about it.
And his old crush, special guest Mary Jo Elliott, is there under a shawl with her monkey-scarred face, again, being exploited.
And that was in the trailers, and I thought that was the alien. I thought that's what we were going to see is the alien, because you saw in the trailer that veil blow up and this weird face. I didn't think it was a scarred human. I thought that was an extraterrestrial.
Right, exactly, which is why if you watch the trailers, you have no idea what the movie is.
This is where we see the alien dolls for sale, a lot of slushies for sale for some reason.
Cactus flavor? Is that a real thing?
I don't know. I was wondering about the cactus flavored one. And then Ricky's got that, yeah, UFO Western jacket on.
Yeah, I love that. I love that moment. Love that moment. He goes out there to walk. There's something under a tarp. He pulls it down. He's telling a story about how his horse Trigger got eaten by a UFO. And he's saying this is going to be the greatest thing you've ever seen. And again, we have that idea that entertainment is blood. And that poor Lucky, the horse that OJ didn't want to sell, he's never going to get an opportunity to get him back because he is the bait to lure down this UFO for the entertainment of this 40-some-odd people.
But something goes wrong, right? Because there is supposed to be some show, but Jean Jackie gets hungry early. He starts lurching forward. And again, great sound design. Feels very ominous. Ricky has really lost control of this situation.
Yeah, I don't know what the agreement is. We'll find out later that Otis Jr. describes it as if you're training an animal, you have to enter into an agreement. Sort of an empathy that needs to happen. I don't think that Ricky properly conveyed the deal, but I'm wondering if Jean Jacket was hoping to get as many things as it could eat. And so it allowed Ricky to create this delusion that he was going to have this big spectacle and then go to town. I would say just wait a couple more. Do one or two performances and then get a really good sized crowd, and then you could eat thousands as opposed to 40.
So you think the deal was for them to be eaten by Jean Jacket?
Oh, I think Jean Jacket was promising Ricky that if he builds it, I'm going to feast.
And when he does eat these people, it's our first look inside the spaceship, as it were. And it's a really weird shot. You get these people, and it looks like, have you ever been in a funhouse, and then at the end, they make you like crawl through Yes. something that's almost like a birth canal? You got to kind of fight your way through this balloon to get out. And that's what they were doing. And I'm like, oh, I see birthing metaphors here. Are they going aboard the ship? Are they going to come out different? No, they're being eaten.
This is my favorite scene. You were talking about your favorite scene. That image of them being sucked up. First of all, just Ricky staring up, having that fear of looking at the ape again as he's staring up at the spaceship. And you can see the silhouettes of all the people being plucked off the stands as the smoke gets thicker and thicker. And of course, Ricky's going to be eaten too. And the next thing you see is, I think it's one of his sons, is the one we follow him all the way up. And it is horrific. I mean, this is just a nightmare.
Oh, really?
Yes. I think it's one of the greatest horrific scenes I can ever think of. Amazing.
The fact that it looked like they were fighting against balloons really just took me out of it.
Being eaten alive, I don't know, has been dramatized better.
Yeah, but we don't, at least I didn't think they were being eaten alive. I didn't know Jean Jacket was an animal at this point. I thought they were being abducted into a ship. I don't know. This was like stuff to clone them or to probe them or do whatever aliens do.
Yep.
But I agree, it's horrific. The screaming, the sheer terror that these extras or the sound design with the screams portray. It is a chilling scene, even though I'm not 100% sure what's going on until later when Jean Jacket's going to shit them all out, I guess.
No. That's the end of the scene. The scene ends with Jean Jacket going to the house.
Okay, so you're counting that as well. Okay.
Yeah, this whole sequence from Ricky walking out there in that amazing red and white Western outfit that you look at the back and you go, wait a minute, that looks like a UFO, to this creature going, you fed me a fake horse and I'm going to fucking paint your house with blood.
I agree. Like when you hear that screaming in the sky, because these people are still alive and then the blood just rains down on this house.
Amazing.
Again, this feels like Amity House or something with the walls bleeding.
Oh, yeah. It's a play on, I mean, how many horror movies have we seen where blood comes out of the walls? But yeah, this is, again, it's doing it intentionally, literally a pissing contest in which it's just telling them, I'm going to make you pay for feeding me a fake horse and spitting that fake horse onto Otis's trailer.
And I did love some of that imagery there and what it did. But I will say, when those people were being eaten, the family behind me laughed. And then after this scene, they left.
They left.
They just got up and left the theater and never returned. I was shocked that they didn't come back. I'm like, why are they all going somewhere? But they never returned.
Yeah, because at this point, I want to know what's going on. I'm not like, again, the first half hour or so feels clunky. As we're getting into this stuff, the pieces are starting to come together. I'm starting to understand more and more what's happening. And as far as horror goes, yeah, this is horrific.
Again, see those people in the stands and you see Mary Jo, you see that outfit, you see the horse that's supposed to be the victim. And the punchline is Lucky lives because he's in that glass case. He's the only thing that doesn't get sucked up into this thing. And then Otis coming over and seeing the pig from the petting zoo on the roof. Just all of this stuff is so great. I really just, I'm so impressed with this sequence.
I think it's undermined by how great the chimp scene was. I never found myself scared in this movie other than with the chimp and the suspense of what the chimp would do. Here, this was well done, though. I'll agree with that. This was a really evocative scene. I just wish I was scared. I wish I was having as big a reaction as you're having, Stuart, because I'm taking this all very academically.
I feel like, though, this is around the time where we learned the twist to go to the M. Night territory. But I feel like, yeah, well, we all knew this was a UFO thing. Not really. It's not a UFO. It's a living organism that just looks like that classic flying saucer.
Is that a good twist? Why is that even a twist? It's just one alien versus a lot. I just think as far as twists go, as far as misdirection from trailer to movie, this didn't really have a huge payoff.
If this was just going to be Signs and gray aliens were going to come out, I don't care. The fact that this is either some like prehistoric Earth animal or something that's floated through space into our atmosphere, that's just more interesting. I don't know if I've seen that before.
And because I watched Lovecraft Country and I know Jordan Peele likes H.P. Lovecraft, my reference was the old ones.
I get that when it unravels itself. Are you thinking that at this point, though?
Are you telling me, am I thinking about it in the moment that I first saw this movie in the scene? Probably not. This is me processing the movie twice.
Yeah, later on, I definitely get the Lovecraftian vibe with it.
Apparently, he had stated that his design is after a throne angel from an anime called Neon Genesis Evangelion.
That's a very popular one. I haven't seen it, though.
Yeah, I'm not talking about what it becomes. I'm talking about specifically the idea that this thing, the old ones lived on Earth. They're gods that lived on Earth, and they're just buried under ice in Antarctica, or they're in a pyramid in Egypt. And if you come across them, if you look at them, you will go crazy. The whole conception of them, turning your eyes to it, the spectacle of that, will drive you insane. Not an easy thing to dramatize, but I do think that this thing was just... Here's my reading. This is the way I take it. This thing was probably a tiny little speck of dust back in 1870s when we first took a moving image. And the metaphor being, as our consumption for more and more bigger and bigger image, bigger spectacle, it too has gotten big. And now it has become the monster itself, feeding that beast. Ricky called it the viewers. That was his name for this. And so it's really the viewers that are the thing that are being wrestled with. I do think there's a very postmodern theme of a man trying to make an IMAX entertainment in the wake of Jaws 50 years later. He's having to wrestle with that and wrestling with our unceasing appetite for that kind of entertainment. How do you keep topping yourself? How do we keep going further? How is this not destructive? As I guess the way that I read Jordan's criticism.
Is he saying the 17 movies and TV shows for Phase 5 and 6 of Marvel is just too much? We've gone too far. It's gotten too big.
Again, for me, the reference is Jaws. For the rest of this movie is essentially a remake of Jaws in which the clouds are the ocean and we're chasing the big fin. Instead of a fin, it's a flying saucer. We have all the archetypes from that movie and it's, we're going to need a bigger horse. They're really trying to think about how we're still trying to take that movie and battle it all these years later. That's the struggle. Is can we outdo it? Can we outpace it? How do we confront that appetite that has only grown for Jaws?
The ultimate irony is that before this movie, I saw a trailer for Jaws. It's coming back to theaters in IMAX 3D.
Yeah, I don't even think that that's ironic. I think that's the comment being made. We just keep trying to go there. And what are we getting out of it? Is it healthy? The ideas are scattered here. And again, only two viewings. Mine aren't completely coherent, but that is the vibe that I'm getting. This movie is very strongly critical of our appetite for entertainment, and specifically for entertainment that is sensationalistic and leads to real life harm, which I assume Jaws didn't. I don't know of anybody that died on that set. But back to the movie, we do have everyone going back to regroup at Angel's house. They go to a seafood restaurant. Again, that nautical imagery of Jaws where they, can we get the Oprah shot becomes really the question. Do we dare to go back to the ranch and get what we set out to do? Everyone has their reasons for doing it. And the answer is, of course, yes. Because what would this movie be if they just stopped here?
So Holst is our Robert Shaw in this. He's going to come back into it and be willing to do this. He's like, this is a camera of my own invention. Didn't they have hand crank cameras way back when?
This is an IMAX one, though.
No. You're missing it. That's the whole point. Their family ranch is built on that hand crank camera that caught the first black jockey on that horse. They are getting back to that tradition. They are denying the spectacle of today's entertainment and saying we're going retro.
Meanwhile, all I'm thinking is, well, the frame rate's probably going to be uneven, but you could fix that in Final Cut.
I mean, that's how they used to do movies. I guess if you're a cinematographer, you know you got that rotation down.
And yes, Holst, you know, they even do the show me the way to go home, you know, that great moment where they're all singing and it's light before it gets scary with Purple People Eater instead. Which, again, it works.
And that made me wonder if that was the damn thing, is this whole movie was based off Purple People Eater.
Is Jean Jacket going to turn purple at the end of this? I was wondering.
The flying saucer was kind of brownish, and it could have been seen as a purple at that point. And if that black thing was its one eye, maybe if it flipped over, we'd see it had one horn.
There is a Leonardo DiCaprio movie about the flying purple people eater. We could maybe review that. I don't think they meant it for it to be that literal. I think they were just trying to evoke that great moment from Jaws. And again, just look at the detritus. Just look at all the, like, the band shirts. Angel has to give them new clothes because they're all messed up and they're wearing Mr. Bungle and Jesus Lizard and all these bands that might have seemed important in the time that have been completely forgotten.
Mr. Bungle's still around. They're still important.
No, they're still around. They never seemed important.
Yeah.
I would disagree.
But you know what I'm saying. I think there is an awareness of all that in creating spectacle gets left behind. Just like when they go back into that park, that great scene where Otis goes back to get his horse, and then there's all those icy cups. All that's left of those people are just the trash, essentially. Again, the metaphor feels heavy and wonderful that what we end up creating are just junk piles. But we need a climax.
And OJ is going to be the bait. He's going to go out there. He thinks he can lure it, but not look at it so that it won't kill him. He can stay out of the way.
He's got eyes on the back of his hood that he pulls up. He's got those fake eyes to get it to follow him.
Right, yes. What he realizes before they left the ranch the second time, when they were getting spat on with blood and the Corey Hart song was slowing down every time the ship passed, is that if he looks up and sees it, he has that memory of his father, that if he sees it, if he looks it in the eye, it's more likely to attack. This thing only has power. Spectacle only has power if you give it your eyes. And so because he's been a character that has never looked at anyone in the eyes, except his sister, they have a sort of way of talking to each other where they do a hand motion that says, I see you. But for the most part, he is going to survive this scene because he can drive out of there without looking up, where everyone else would be tempted.
I'm going to have a lot of compliments for this climax, but again, where I get confused, and maybe it makes more sense on a second viewing, I get what they're doing. It feels out of place is this guy in a motorcycle drives up. He's got this very strange motorcycle helmet that's mirrored. It looks like that ball that spooks the horse at the beginning, but it's got like one eye hole. So I'm like, okay, this is like some weird government agent that knows about Jean Jacket, knows you can't look at it. Maybe that helmet's supposed to attract it because it's reflective or something. But then they say, oh, it's a TMZ reporter, and it just ends up being a TMZ reporter. And I get the metaphor if this is about trash media, but it's just a bizarre image. And again, you got to edit some of those ideas out.
This goes too over the top. When he gets in that accident, because we haven't really talked about it, but whenever the alien comes near, things lose power. And so he's riding a motorcycle at like 60 miles an hour. Motorcycle loses power. He flings over the motorcycle, breaks his legs.
And they know this is going to happen. I love this setup is they got all these wiggly men, air blower things you see at car lots. I'm like, well, what is that? Is that supposed to, like, fool Jean Jacket to think they're people? No, it's a way to measure what power is being knocked out. And when you see them deflating as that motorcycle's approaching them, I'm like, oh, that's a really smart way to show why they did this. Again, there are times where I feel like Peele's ideas are sharp and spot on, but I don't understand why TMZ's there.
Funniest joke in the entire damn movie is when M says, we're filming a Verizon commercial, because those are always in those damn Verizon commercials. But yeah, when he's laying on the ground broken and M is trying to help him and he's like, take the picture. That is too over the top. I'm rolling my eyes. That is the one moment of this movie I actively dislike.
Agreed. This does not work. I agree. It's a conceit. You get why he wanted it to work, but it doesn't work. And it probably could have easily been removed from the film without anyone noticing it. But it looks cool. Like he looks like he's in Daft Punk with a helmet and all of that. And they want to have, a representation of someone who, I mean, the point is he's lying there bleeding and he's more upset that that death is not being photographed than the fact that he's dying. And again, I see what you're going for. It's part of the themes, but it really doesn't feel tonally like it fits into this moment. It takes you out. What would otherwise be a great scene of a ship flying around through the clouds and wind dancers dropping and coming back on. Yeah, all of this stuff is good. They really built a cool looking climax.
There's a great shot where I think they even showed it in the commercial, but seeing it on the big screen, probably even more so on IMAX, where it's just Daniel Kaluuya on a horse riding and just that UFO or Jean Jacket taking up the whole width of the screen behind him as the dust comes up. Beautiful shot.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, gorgeous.
It's powerful. And what they've figured out, their teamwork together. Remember, she was the thimble. Emerald sewed a parachute. And so when the ship was coming to swallow him, it remembered the string of flags that it didn't like, that it choked on from the fake horse when he releases that parachute. And thus it rears back and he gets away and they get the shot. It seems like they have the Oprah shot now. All of that was caught on the hand crank camera by the genius cinematographer. And here's another scene that I don't feel entirely works.
He needs that impossible shot.
Yeah, I get that you have a character that's devoted to imagery, that's spent his whole life trying to visualize the impossible, and so he needs to essentially capture death on camera.
He says it's almost the magic hour. Is it that he really wants the shot to be pretty and get it during that 1 hour of sunset?
Yeah.
You can never be satisfied with the spectacle. This was a brilliant shot, and he's still wanting more. And so he won't be satisfied until it consumes him. And so what he described earlier about being on top of the mountain with all eyes on him is his death.
And we never see that film canister get puked out or anything. I thought for sure that's how they would get the shot. Like, they kill it or something, or it just spits it out because it can't digest it. And they'd have that film, even though the cinematographer died.
I like the idea of the moment more than I like the way that the moment comes off. It's kind of awkward, as a lot of this is right here near the end. It's clunky. You killed Robert Shaw, you have to kill this guy. But I wish it landed a little bit more firmly.
I wish it was a shock. I wish it was horrific. I wish that they had that moment where they think they have victory, and then Jean Jacket did something unexpected that sucked him up and robbed them of their victory, instead of having the cinematographer just basically go nuts.
Well, again, if the theme is our obsession with capturing visuals is our undoing, if you buy that, then it makes sense that he would never be satisfied with any shot until it was over.
Yeah, I get the metaphor, but like a lot of things in this, it's clunky.
You know, Captain Ahab and the whale. I mean, again, that pursuit of the impossible can be all-consuming. And it almost kills Angel, but I think he was smart enough to wrap himself in a tarp and use that barbed wire fence.
He was smart enough to go to Jordan Peele and say, "Can you please not kill me? I'd like to come back for the sequel."
Well, Richard Dreyfuss didn't die in Jaws.
No, but in the script, Angel was dead. And he actually talked to Jordan Peele and talked him out of it.
Oh, that's real. He was supposed to die.
Yeah.
Again, I don't think there will be a sequel because Jordan Peele hasn't been making them. He seems to like original concepts. But yeah, I can imagine that this is a character audiences are happy are there at the end, as opposed to these siblings that, yeah, I think we've all said we've been kind of cold on. And here, they've really tried to make that tension in their relationship part of this climax. He's wearing the Scorpion King crew shirt, even though he would have been 9 years old or whatever.
Maybe it's his dad's, so it fits him now.
Yeah, you're right. It's probably his dad's. But yeah, he's wearing the thing that she resents him for having the opportunity to do. And now he's going to pay her back by self-sacrificing. It just doesn't quite land. I just don't quite buy this moment.
Well, ironically, I'm caught up in the spectacle. I'm not paying attention to these human relationships. This is where I get the real Cthulhu vibe, as Jean Jacket is like this weird origami creature that starts to unfold and get bigger and massive. I thought it was a real interesting design, and to see it expand like that was neat. We don't see it do much, but I thought that was a pretty cool way to reveal what Jean Jacket actually was.
It became very pretty, like the sails of a sailboat, but it became less threatening the more pretty it became. It became almost beatific, and then when it's trying to eat you out of this little square mouth in the middle of it, it was less frightening than the saucer was.
Yeah, I don't call this a horror movie. I would just go ahead and put it out there. Jordan Peele dabbles in horror. It has horrific elements, but this is much more of a science fiction film than it is straight up horror, in the way that Us and Get Out were straight up horror. Yeah, what are they going for? That's what I kept wondering here. Obviously, a flying saucer, that's a misdirect. It makes us think there's little green men inside. And then, I mean, it should be said, we were inside the ship from the earliest shots, right when the credits began. They had that wonderful visual. We didn't know what we were looking at, but there's a black square in the middle of the screen, and it's like this undulating sort of hallway that seems to be screaming. It's almost like the movie theater itself. I took this representation for much of it as a giant eye or a giant movie screen, and maybe this is an unspooling camera here with all the ribbon. That was kind of what I took it. It was an IMAX camera come to life to attack us. And yes, it's beautiful, just like IMAX imagery is, but the criticism that Peele seems to be saying is spectacle in this day and age has become too much.
And they send up a giant balloon, like cowboy balloon, which, look, you don't look this creature in the eye, but I'm rolling my eyes at this. This is how they're going to like trap it and lure it and I guess kill it.
Too clever by half. We have to somehow echo what happened with Gordy and the balloons flying up and popping in the lights.
Is it the helium explosion that kills Jean Jacket? Like, yes. I didn't even understand. Or does it have a latex allergy and that's what killed it?
I think they just like the idea of Ricky getting revenge.
I think that was a little bit silly. I could understand it choking on it, but the fact that the balloon pops and it blows out the back of the alien, this is not a good climax.
It's a mixed bag. It truly is a mixed bag. Wonderful stuff mixed with, again, really smart ideas that actually don't work. It'll be great because it'll just be like the Gordy thing, except you realize that it doesn't truly thematically connect in ways that are meaningful.
Yeah, I like the way this alien being or this old one is like this weird giant jellyfish in the air. I love how M is cranking that camera really hard to take those pictures. And then you got like that balloon. And that kind of represents this whole film for me. Like, good, bad, good, bad. It's uneven for me.
Yeah, agreed.
I think for me, just to call it out, that's Kid Sheriff. That is Ricky. Essentially, it's him coming back from the dead and killing the thing that killed him. Should he have vengeance? Should he be able to get that? I don't know. Maybe this is all just a joke on spaghetti westerns and those high noon showdowns. I don't know. It feels like some half clever idea that just, I can see why you might think this is the ending. And then you work on it a little bit more and you come up with something else. Was most central to Peel that what captures the Oprah shot is this very old, again, technology.
That kind of moves in a circle one frame at a time, like that first video of a black man riding a horse.
Correct, exactly. We're getting back to the idea of what film should be. I'm trying not to hear the judginess in it, but that's the way it's coming off to me. It's that Peele feels, and it probably comes from working on a big budget movie where he's dealing with Hollywood assholes, but he's feeling like this need to pursue spectacle and make movies in this climate is not pure cinema.
And the creature designer on the film did come out and say that the way it's designed, this did not actually kill Jean Jacket. That they viewed it as like a jellyfish where you could tear it apart and it will like hibernate and heal itself and come back together. So
the old ones may rise again.
Yeah, I don't think the old ones ever died either. Cthulhu's, yeah, he could be vanquished but never killed. But it's kind of a happy ending. Again, they frame it in terms of Emerald releasing the balloon, getting the Oprah shot, and then turning to see her brother framed with Old Yonder above him in a classic spaghetti western kind of pose, that this has been a healing family moment. Again, that just doesn't work for me.
Yeah, that did not work at all for me.
It doesn't work, right? We can all agree whatever this movie means and whatever we like about it, the fact that those two are going to continue to have a relationship is not it. Get out with that.
Yeah, it's siblings I never really cared about, so this moment kind of just falls flat.
That's the one time where I really said nope.
But what will you say when I ask, Jacob Stewart, do you recommend Nope? Jacob.
I was shocked when I walked out of the theater how conflicted I was. And again, this is the first time we've done a Jordan Peele film pretty close to its release, where we had a seat in theaters and then come review it before they had been out for a year or so. And I remember, Stewart, we saw Us together along with my wife, mm-hmm. and I remember you saying you were conflicted with that one, and then when we reviewed it, you were very positive. So I think maybe this one can grow on me, but I'm going to have to see it again because, yeah, this first time, there's a lot of just clunkiness is the way I put it. It never really feels like it gets into its grooves. There are great moments. The scene with the blood being showered on the house and that chimpanzee in the TV studio. Like, there are great moments, but as a film, it's hard to gel for me. And it hurts that it's got characters I don't really get myself invested in. When they put this team together, it's not the same as in Jaws when you got that team at the end. Like, those are characters that have grit to them and are interesting, and they have this fun little moment on the boat. I don't know. I never really get that vibe here. So I think Peele, again, not just editing as the way the film is cut, but just the ideas needed to be edited as well. I think he's got a lot of ideas here. Is this about Hollywood? You know, when you think about movies about Hollywood, you have highs like Sunset Boulevard, which are great. And then you have really crazy films like The Stuntman, which I don't know what that film is really about, except it's a movie about a movie.
Yeah.
And so that is a dangerous thing, too. I think there's some more universal themes. There may be a lot of themes. I've seen so many debates after I saw this on what does this film mean? And that could be a good thing or a bad thing. I don't know. It means there's a lot of ideas put in here. And again, it's not a polished film, and maybe it will grow on me when I see it again. I do plan on seeing it again because, yeah, I'm going to give this a mild recommend. I want to see it again. I want to see if there's more there to it, if those bumps get smoothed out a little bit. I have hope for that, and I did enjoy it. I just felt like, yeah, this is the weakest of his three films, but it's still a mild recommend for Nope.
Stuart.
Yeah. Does Jordan Peele achieve the ambitions of one-upping Jaws and every summer movie that came after it? Nope. But he does manage to string together a lot of evocative, nightmarish moments that have real power that really will stay with you. And I just like being in his hands. I just like him as a filmmaker. I like the way that he tells stories, even when the stories could use another pass. So, yes, I will always remember the blood-covered chimp giving the fist bump. I will always remember the disfigured woman in the stands being sucked up and eaten in the going into the innards of the ship. Yeah, there's a lot here that I will take away, but I can recognize. Again, I'm humble enough to say I don't have this movie all figured out, and maybe there is a lot that I've missed, but I can say for sure I didn't enjoy it as much as the other two. It's not going to be just figuring it out and liking the movie. There's something about, I think you used the word clunky, Jacob,
yeah.
And I do feel like there's something about the way these ideas collide that feels less satisfying for me than when things pair nicely together. I mean, I guess they're just different flavors here, and they don't all taste good together, even if you might ultimately decide there's a lot to this meal. There's a lot of nutrition to what it's offering. And again, I think, yeah, thematically, I see religious themes. I see bitterness about Hollywood. I see all kinds of games and puzzles being worked out and references. It's a very intelligent film made by a very talented filmmaker. So even when Jordan Peele is not at his best, I think you definitely want to see it on an IMAX screen. It's a solid recommend.
I think we all mostly saw the same film, although Stuart saw a lot of allegorical content that I didn't. I'm not saying it's not there. I actually really enjoyed this. I intentionally stayed away from reading any analyses or anything about this film.
Me too.
I tried to parse something together in my own head. I didn't put that together as a commentary on film. And like Jacob said, this may be a film that grows on me more. But I take absolutely no delight in the fact that when you ask, do I recommend this? My answer is nope. It just is a film that I think didn't gel. It has some great high points, like Gordy the Chimp. That is something that will stick with me. But this film feels like it did go off the spool a little bit.
Is that a bad thing? Does everything have to hold together to be worthwhile?
Yes.
No, it doesn't. There are beautiful messes.
And this is a mess, and it's beautifully shot, but it was not an entertaining time, which is something that I credit Jordan Peele with giving, is commentary and entertainment. And here, there's commentary sans entertainment.
Well, there's a lot of that's entertaining here. You complimented as such. Maybe it didn't all come together for you, but I don't know how you couldn't.
I didn't have a good time watching this movie at all.
In a week where you gave Underdog a recommend, I am personally hurt that you gave Nope a nope.
I understand that. And, you know, again, we make the comparison. These are not apples to apples comparisons. I am not reviewing Nope like I would review Underdog. Okay, we grade on a curve here. And Jordan Peele has set himself up to be in the AP class. And here he fell short. And again, I'm not taking any pleasure in giving this a not recommend. But when I walked out of that theater, I felt like I had wasted way too much time. This movie is too long. And I didn't click with the characters except for Angel. And it's really good looking. There's a lot of talent on display. It's a weak not recommend. But if somebody asks me, should I go see that movie? My answer is nope.
I mean, again, the fact that there are mysteries to unpack, doesn't that just in and of itself make it more rewarding than most of the movies we've watched this summer?
Nope. Because I didn't have a single clue into any of those mysteries until you talked about them. I did state, and I will reiterate, this movie could grow on me as I live with it longer.
I mean, you're not recommending it. Will you watch it again, though?
Yeah, that's the curiosity. I get that you're saying it wasn't completely satisfying, but for you to say it's not worth watching, I just don't get why you wouldn't want to spend more time with it.
Ask me again in a year. When we get to Jordan Peele's next film, ask me if I've ruminated on this and my feelings have changed. I'm not rushing to watch it again.
It should be said you weren't that big on Get Out when you first saw it. And now I hear you saying you really love it.
Right. Jordan Peele's films, I stated at the very top of this, it does Nope no favors with me to review it right after seeing it in theaters.
I think that's true. And true for me as well. Again, yes, Us was a grower. Get Out I loved from this get-go. But
yeah.
Us was a grower, and this one, seeing it a second time, definitely helped. But even in that second viewing, I could tell it was never going to be my favorite.
Yeah, that was the shock for me, is Get Out, loved it the first time I saw it. Us, loved that one the first time I saw it. This one, I haven't felt this conflicted with his films before, and I'm like, huh, so this is what Stewart felt like when he saw Us the first time.
But again, what I would argue is, even if you didn't love it, again, you can love the craftsmanship, you can love so much about it, I don't know how you throw that away. This one is worth keeping.
If I haven't made myself clear, I don't know how to state it any plainer.
Anyway, let's keep in the horror tradition. Next month, September patrons, we've had a request for a Roman Polanski horror movie that probably would be considered underrated. Johnny Depp being directed by Roman Polanski. They're together making what I remember to be kind of a goofy semi-comedy anyway, called The Ninth Gate, about a librarian that finds a book that leads him to hell.
Sounds great.
We'll see.
So that will be the September patron show. And as a $10 patron, you're also going to get to hear us, because patrons get the Silver Level series as well, and the Addams Family.
Oh, the snap. I get what you're doing now.
The Addams Family will be coming between now and then.
Yep, we're talking about all iterations of that. Believe it or not, it started as a New Yorker cartoon that became a TV show, that became movies in the 90s, that became sad straight-to-video films, that became animated films. We're going to follow the whole saga and Nintendo games and everything else.
Yeah, don't forget Fester's Quest. I loved Fester's Quest.
Oh, awful. Hated that game.
I love Fester's Quest.
You loved it?
I love that game.
Awful.
That was one of my first Nintendo purchases.
You really did get a Nintendo late if that was one of your first purchases.
It was. I was the last person to get the Nintendo NES, yeah. But anyway, 6 Addams Family films for you if you keep up the patronage. I hope you've enjoyed the show. I know I enjoyed the conversation, even though I'm a little sad, again, that you can't get on board with a recommend, Arnie. I've had a lot of fun talking about it with you and Jacob.
Same here. I enjoyed your analysis of the film more than I enjoyed the film itself, to be perfectly honest. So thank you for joining me, patrons. Thank you for supporting us as we continue podcasting into the future. But for now, we're going to nope on out of here.
Thank you to all the listeners who have backed us through our crowdfunding campaign, and we hope you've enjoyed this special bonus movie review podcast.
So what happens next?
Help us spread the word about this show by leaving a 5-star review on Stitcher, Podbean, iTunes, or your podcast store of choice.
You'll be getting a call from my supervisor asking how my service was.
5 stars, Angel, 5 stars.
The opinions expressed on Now Playing are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the opinion of Venganza Media Incorporated.
You guys gonna tell me what's going on?
Hell no.
Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with the motion pictures reviewed or otherwise referred to herein. All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review and no infringement is intended.
Sure looks strange to me.
Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of Venganza Media Incorporated and may not be used without the expressed written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2022, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
We like to say, since the moment pitchers could move, we had skin in the game.
And you telling me, like, Jordan Peterson's doing a horror film called, like, the title alone, Nope.
Do you mean Jordan Peele?
Who did I say?
Yeah, you said Peterson.
Oh, no. Not Jordan Peterson.